Where to start? You've come to websites like mine and to conference calls like this one because you're looking for answers. You've experienced something most people never experience directly, most people aren't aware of, and which rarely gets discussed seriously. Your reality isn't like other people's reality. It's got something extra. Call it Reality Plus. If you're lucky, or persistent, or smart, or observant, you've gone even further than this. You've learned that what you thought you knew about this secret, this incredible reality-altering secret, was wrong. You had to readjust your beliefs, or even reevaluate everything you thought you understood about the world. Maybe you've gone through this adjustment process several times, and as a result, you don't know what to believe. Some of your associates haven't gone through this adjustment process at all. They're the unlucky ones. If you spend years chasing something that turns out to be an illusion, you don't get that time back. You don't get back the resources that you wasted. The world doesn't work that way. Because of this, it's crucially important for you to confront the true nature of what's been hidden from you as soon as possible. Some of what's been hidden from you is you. You operate in your own blind spot. Your unconscious motivations, your cognitive biases, your perceptual limitations, your bad habits, your mistaken beliefs, things about you that are special and things about you that are ordinary, and maybe you don't know which of those things is which. Much of this is unseen to you. Possibly there is even a past of yours that you don't know about. Since the reality you experience is filtered by you and interpreted by you, what you don't know about you may just lead you on a wild goose chase, engineered by people who know you better than you do. There's more that's been hidden from you. Consider the people you associate with or pay attention to, online or offline, now that you're looking for answers. Some of what's been hidden from you about those people, at some point, you discovered them. Were you intended to discover them? Were you actually led to them without your knowing it? If so, what does that mean? Are they even less knowledgeable about their situation than you are, but hide it with confident-sounding and utterly wrong banter? Where are they getting their information from? Do they have ulterior motives? The people you've only encountered online, how many of them don't even exist? Something else that's been hidden from you is technology. The term I use to describe hidden technology here is crypto technology. Crypto technology differs from technology that you merely don't know about in that there's a concerted effort being made to conceal its workings from you and to misrepresent what it does or how it works, as well as mislead individuals and the general public about whether it's being used at any given time. An example of crypto technology that you've probably experienced personally and knowingly is stage magic. Magicians work what seem to be miracles with ordinary objects. In reality, the objects may be doctored to have unusual properties which are invisible to the naked eye. There may be confederates in the audience who secretly help the performer with his illusions. A professional magician also knows how to draw your attention away from sleights of hand. If it's so easy for a man who's making a living as a stage magician to fool a large audience of people who know they are being tricked, just imagine how much easier it is when the audience doesn't know they're being tricked, and the performer has much more in the way of resources. What I'm suggesting is that you've been tricked, and you don't know you've been tricked, much less who has tricked you or how they did it, or why they did it. And if you're sure you know the answers to any of these questions, I'm even more sure that you only think you know the answers. Nobody is more easily tricked than the person who thinks he can't be tricked, that he couldn't have been tricked. You're aware of the deception on some level, naturally. Your way of thinking may have adapted to deception, seen and unseen, in ways that are toxic to you. For example, you may have decided that certain positions are truthful or good, and others are lies or bad. and if anyone says the good things, they're your friends, to be promoted whenever possible. And if anyone expresses the bad positions, they're your enemy, to be undermined whenever possible. I shouldn't have to tell you that such a way of thinking will prevent you from learning anything new ever again. Welcome to the prison, Population You, constructed by you. A no less dangerous way of thinking involves categorizing people as trustworthy or untrustworthy. If they're trustworthy, everything they say, even if it's ridiculous, is meant to help you and contains the seeds of enlightenment. If they're untrustworthy, everything they say is meant to mislead you, even if they're telling the truth. Maybe this isn't really a way of thinking so much as an emotional reaction, and the thoughts that follow from it are rationalization. But the views expressed are definitely reactionary. A reactionary mode of problem solving can get you places that blind acceptance wouldn't. For example, consider the mainstream media treatment of UFOs, ghosts, and psychics. It's open-minded, flattering, even mainstream. But there's one topic closely related to those topics which only gets unfavorable treatment. UFOs and extraterrestrials? Hey, it's a big universe. Anything might be out there and might have come here to visit. It's not our place to judge. Ghosts and psychics? We can't be sure. We have to keep an open mind. What about someone who says he's being experimented on or persecuted by the US government? That guy's mentally ill. End of discussion. If you think about the mainstream media and what its incentives are and who owns it and who it's working for, a reactionary mode of thought in which anything the MSM says is intended to create or reinforce misleading views about its host government's secret activities seems reasonable. But reactionary thinking will only take you so far. One topic that comes up on sites related to these issues, as well as the conference calls, is this notion of opposition, which might be false or imagined. The idea is, if you're trying to do something, and you think you're being prevented from doing it, then obviously this must be a good thing. And you have to try even harder, or get the word out so others can do it for you. Websites related to this topic keep disappearing, so obviously they must be suppressing those sites, right? Well, maybe the authors of those sites came to the realization they had been completely wrong about the topics they were covering, and disappeared off the scene to save themselves further embarrassment. A reactionary viewpoint would never harbor that possibility. Here's something I've heard a few times. We've got to get over the speculation and the theorizing and just stop it. Stopping it sounds like a nice idea, but first we have to define what it is. I can go on video sharing sites right now and find self-described gang-stalking victims posting videos of themselves stalking strangers, ostensibly to gather evidence. I can go elsewhere on the internet and find some of the same people attacking anyone who disagrees with their views. I think those people are part of the it that needs to be stopped. Here's a question. Have you ever gone online or to conferences and shared authoritative sources or experienced researchers who seem to support what you believed, even though those sources look ridiculous to outsiders? Maybe those sources would look ridiculous to you too, if you just looked at them with a critical eye. Maybe those sources and your suspension of disbelief are also part of the it, and that needs to be stopped as well. Stop it, they say. But when you study what it is, you invariably find that something inside you is part of it. That means to get past it, you're going to have to confront yourself. I'll conclude with a thought. Remember what I've said about the time you've lost chasing illusions. It's true, you're not getting that time back. But if you focus your attention elsewhere, looking for not the illusions, but for the stuff illusions are made of, you can put an end to the chase. You might even find that not all that time was wasted after all. Okay. That concludes the educational portion of the podcast. Now, let's get into what's been happening with me. After my final podcast of 2011 in June, things continued south, and by late August, I was homeless. I knew one thing. I didn't want to be on the streets, especially once it started getting cold. So I went to a homeless shelter. Now, if you're one of the regulars on calls like these, if you're all wrapped up in gang stalking and you think you're surrounded by perps who are trying to destroy you, I guess some place like a homeless shelter or the public housing I ended up in later would be pretty horrible. But I'm way past that. There were a few things that happened that my handlers had a hand in and that I couldn't complain about because it sounded crazy, but overall, I experienced these things pretty much the way any other person would experience them. There's been a few stories this year about politicians and journalists going undercover at homeless shelters. But the people who provided the material for those stories, they typically only stay a couple of nights. That's long enough to be shocked at the conditions, but not enough time to find out what's really going on. What makes a shelter and its residents tick? The place I went to was called Haven. It's funded by outside money. The people running that shelter have to go out there and raise funds, and the big donors especially want a contract that guarantees they're getting what they pay for. So what I'm saying is that the money that goes into the shelter has strings attached. Then there's state and federal matching funds, and those come with more strings attached. So there were some annoying rules, because the shelter has to be able to prove compliance to its donors. And I'll probably talk about that in a bit. When I entered Haven for the first time, the first thing I did was I filled out a lot of forms. Then I got assigned a bed in a room with four other men. I noticed a couple things. The entire shelter was climate controlled at about 72 degrees. This was actually an improvement on the apartment I'd been living in. I also took a shower as soon as possible, and again, I noticed that the bathroom and shower facilities were much better than what I'd been using. But sleeping in unfamiliar surroundings on a small bed surrounded by strangers is tough, especially if you're not used to that sort of thing. That seems to be universal. Everyone gets very little sleep their first night. I got used to it after that. It seems to be pretty common that shelters want residents out of the dormitories after the certain time of the morning, ideally to work or to look for work. Haven's like that. You have to be out of the living area by 10 and can't come back until 4. Now, if you're like I was at that point and you don't have transportation and you spent several years out of work, you're going to find it pretty hard to get a job, especially in a stagnant economy, and most especially in Lorain, Ohio. I spend a lot of time walking. If you're going to be homeless, you need good shoes. Within a few days of getting in, I had been guided to the Metro Housing Authority, and I applied for a subsidized apartment. From there on out, it was all about waiting. It takes time for them to do a background check, and time for housing to open up once you pass the check. I really can't complain about that background check. I'd much rather live in housing where the worst troublemakers and vandals and thieves and so on are screened out in advance. What was it like waiting in the shelter? Like I said, it was a climate-controlled environment. They had a dining room with snacks, bread, cereal, peanut butter and jelly, and the occasional treat, and you could drop into it at any time during the day. They also had hot meals for lunch and dinner. With occasional exceptions, lunches and dinners were pretty bad. It's kind of interesting to consider why that is. While most of the chores at the shelter were performed by the residents themselves, the cooking, as opposed to serving meals, was done by the staff. I'm guessing they didn't pay enough to attract a food service professional. It's definitely different cooking for dozens of people at once, as opposed to preparing a meal for your family. There's the ingredients themselves. In addition to the financial contributions the shelter gets, it's also going to get food contributions. That means a lot of canned food, a lot of recently expired bread and pastries from local bakeries. Residents will get lots of sugary and starchy food. There's also a handful of staples like cereal and milk that they actually go out and buy. Fresh vegetables and fruit and high-quality meat come in sometimes, but a lot of it goes bad before it can be used. And I suspect some of the really good stuff goes out the back door. If you want to donate good food to a shelter and you want to be sure that the residents get to eat it, you better prepare the meal yourself and serve it yourself. Practically everyone staying at the shelter is on food stamps, and they ended up spending those stamps on junk food or on microwave-ready meals, so they'd be sure to have something they could eat. I wasn't the only one wondering why those food stamps can't be pulled and used to purchase the ingredients for high-quality meals for the residents. Earlier I mentioned the shelter's funding had strings attached. Like, for example, mandatory attendance of anger management classes and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, a total of 3 meetings a week. Missing 3 meetings would be cause for eviction from the shelter. The anger management classes were hosted by a Vietnam vet. He was a pretty earnest guy, and he understood most of the residents didn't want to be there. He was saying stuff that was very similar to the subjects I covered in my final podcast last year. Maybe in a more roundabout way, maybe not quite as focused. Maybe some people listening to this call could benefit from anger management classes in their area. The Alcoholics Anonymous meetings were a drag. There's no sugarcoating it. Practically everyone there was coerced into going. Residents like myself or drunk drivers who had been court-ordered to attend. There were a few people who showed up of their own free will to every meeting they could find, sometimes including ours. So, alcohol or drugs had taken over their lives, and now Alcoholics Anonymous had taken over their lives. But there was one funny detail. Quite a few residents complained about the AA meetings. "I'm not an alcoholic. I don't need to be here," they'd say. And it turned out that a few of those people complaining were drug addicts, or alcoholics who just didn't happen to have the money they needed to get drunk at the time. One more thing. Being on a homeless shelter in the 2 weeks before Christmas is pretty nice. You get organizations bringing in pizza or home-cooked meals practically every night. You get many free gifts. There were even gift cards. All in all, those months at the shelter could have been a lot worse. Practically anything is better than living on the streets in a cold Ohio winter. There was something peculiar that happened in the shelter. The second to last month I was there, November of last year, I had my assigned room practically all to myself. And then one day, 4 guys were admitted to the shelter, and they were all assigned to my room. 2 of them were loud snorers. 1 of them was a very loud snorer. I started having sleeping problems. Sometime in December, I can't recall exactly when this was, the sleeping problems got much worse. I was only getting 3 hours, no more, at a stretch, and I wouldn't be able to get back to sleep before 10 a.m. when we were required to get out of our rooms and sleep was, for all intents and purposes, no longer possible. At the time, I blamed this on my roommates and a few other residents at the shelter. I was getting very irritable. But when I came to a friend's place on the bus, and I was so tired at that point, I was nodding off all through the bus ride, I tried to sleep on her couch and then on a comfortable bed, and I couldn't do it. That was when I learned that she and several people we both knew were also having sleep problems at the same time in early December. Then the pretense was dropped. There was something coordinated happening to us, many of us, in December last year. It seems like in my case, some people were offered up in the shelter as distractions or scapegoats, so I blame them instead of seeing the bigger picture. I'd rather hold off on guessing what that bigger picture is, though. Moving on. I made it in a public housing and moved in at the end of December. The shelter provided me with a mattress and let me keep the bedding I'd been using, which helped. So I was living in subsidized housing based on a portion of my income, and since I was earning nothing at the time, that meant I paid nothing. Some of you on the call might want to look into this. If you're having trouble paying rent or you're homeless, chances are you're eligible for something similar. Anyway, now that I wasn't being forced to be certain places at certain times, I could investigate a lead I'd found while I was at the shelter, a day labor outfit called Minutemen. This is basically a temp service. After a few days, actually, I guess it was a few weeks. I showed up for a few weeks, every chance I could. And one of their clients had a big surge in demand, and I caught it. I had to take a shuttle to Minutemen and back just to get a ride to the job site. Because this shuttle, run by Lorain County, had very limited hours, I found it was best to take a late afternoon shuttle back to Minutemen, work all night, and then take the early morning shuttle to my place. So basically, I kept showing up at Minutemen until they started needing people on a regular basis around mid-February. And then I got myself to work one way or another every single day until a few days ago, when I started getting ready for my next move. With no expenses, I was able to save up money very quickly to buy a car and get other essentials. The government services were helpful. This kind of illustrates a point I've made about targeting. One hand of the government doesn't necessarily know what the other does. It would be nice if we could have the good stuff without also having the bad stuff the people on this call are familiar with. So about this day labor outfit. There's probably something very much like it in your area. I went into the situation having absolutely no idea what I was getting myself into, except for one detail. If I worked the day I showed up, I would be getting a paycheck for my work at the end of that day. That much I knew. Now, this promise of a paycheck every day attracts some undesirable elements, like junkies. It also brings in people who are really hard up for cash. For the types of assignments Minuteman typically offers, there's essentially no background check, so there are going to be a lot of convicted felons attracted to the job. The assignment I spent most of my time on was at a greenhouse, Green Circle Growers. It's a pretty major greenhouse. It supplies the flowers for every Home Depot and Walmart in the U.S. The job pays minimum wage or just above it, and I don't think most people are prepared for just how hard they're going to be working for $7.75 to $8.50 an hour at Green Circle. But you adapt. The first few days wiped me out. By the time I left, it was no big deal. A lot of people don't make it past that first day. Someone at Green Circle said to me, "Think of it as a workout that you're getting paid for." There's something to that point of view. But for me, I went in for something specific, didn't expect anything else, and didn't get anything else. There was no skill development. I wasn't saving the world. It was just about the money. I made my stake, and now I'm moving on. Like I said, I've been living in public housing rent-free, but after 3 months of being employed, I was about to start getting charged rent. All things considered, there were lots of incentives for me to look at getting out of the area. There are jobs that require little in the way of qualifications that pay decently, but you have to be willing to do whatever is necessary to get yourself to the job site, and you have to be willing to tough it out. You could get into commercial fishing, coal mining, or oil drilling as examples. I'm shooting for the latter. When there are lots of high-paying jobs in an area, there are also going to be lots of support jobs, people making their living selling goods and services to the highly paid workers. So in the area I'm moving to, I'm keeping my eyes open and not ruling anything out. I'm heading to the oil fields around North Dakota. I'm taking off on Monday. It's a 1,300-mile trip. I'll be making a few stops along the way, but I want to get there as soon as possible. The fun doesn't stop once I show up. Lots of people have gone and are going to North Dakota for work. There's no housing available anywhere within 100 miles. One reason I got myself a minivan before heading out there was so I'd be sure to have a place to sleep. The main thing I have to keep in mind, and you do too if you're following along or want to replicate what I've done, is that I'm not in full control of this situation. My stay at Green Circle was made unpleasant because of mild sleep deprivation, about 4 hours a night, but not intolerable. I could have been stopped in my tracks. Full sleep deprivation would have made it impossible for me to work. I have a vehicle, but that could easily be taken away from me too. It's kind of like I'm being taken on a ride. I'm choosing to be observant and to learn things on the way, and I'm not taking it too seriously.